Good morning. I'd like to call a meeting to order of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. It is Thursday, March 6, 2025, and we do have a quorum present. Today we will begin with Senate File 1083, Senator Kupek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have Senate File 1083. This is kind of a correction bill. I don't know, this probably will not be the shortest bill we heard this session. I think Senator Makewade has already beaten us on that. But Senate File 1083 has no opposition. It adds 11 words that were inadvertently not included when Physician Assistant Practice Act was updated in 2020. Thank my co-authors, who are most of this committee, Senator Utke, Bolden, Liske, and you, Madam Chair, Senator Wicklund. Currently, Minnesota recognizes the training received in other states by all healthcare providers except physician assistants. During the 2020 HHS Conference Committee, authority for the Board of Medical Practice to recognize and the training of PAs receive in other states or U.S. territories was inadvertently dropped. This means a PA is trained at a nationally accredited PA program cannot move here and begin seeing patients like any other licensed healthcare provider that moves here. They have to restart with 2,080 hours of clinical training in collaboration with a Minnesota-based licensed physician. These delays have meant PAs have not been allowed to practice, and there's delays in patients from getting care. This was not the intent of the 2020 bill. So in your package, you'll find a letter from the Board of Medical Practice confirming its support for this correction. The MMA has reviewed this language, and they have no concerns. And as far as we know, nobody is against this bill.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions about the bill or comments? No? Well, Senator Kupek, I don't see any questions raised. I think it makes sense, and it's surprising to me that it didn't get fixed earlier, but we'll take care of it this year. So we will be laying the bill over for inclusion later. So Senate File 1083 is laid over.
Thank you.
And next we will go to Senate File 1534, Senator Bolden. And Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an author's A1 amendment, which just corrects a drafting error.
Senator Bolden moves the A1 amendment. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for considering this bill this morning. Last session, a new license was established for speech-language pathology assistants, or SLPAs, who work under the supervision of a licensed speech-language pathologist to help individuals with communication disorders. After that legislation was passed, we learned that two clarifications were needed, and that is why I come with this bill this morning. Sections 1 and 2 of this bill clarify that the supervision of an SLPA working in a school setting is supervised by a speech-language pathologist licensed under the Public Educator Licensing Standards Board, and an assistant working with a healthcare setting is supervised by a speech-language pathologist licensed under MDH. And then sections 4 and 5 propose to reduce the fees for the assistant licensure and appropriates an unspecified amount to cover the cost of setting up the license. The proposed $493 licensing fee for speech-language pathology assistants, or SLPAs, is more than double that of fully licensed speech-language pathologists, who pay only $210. SLPAs typically earn significantly less than SLPs, making this disproportionate fee an unnecessary barrier to entry. High licensing fees could discourage qualified professionals from entering the field, worsening workforce shortages, and limiting access to essential speech therapy services, and was not the intention of the original bill. SLPAs also have different and typically lower education requirements than SLPs. I will say that we have met with MDH to discuss the bill and continue to be in conversation and working to address some questions they have regarding the supervision requirements, while also seeking a cost estimate to reduce the assistant licensing fees. And with that, Madam Chair, do have a testifier.
Yes, we have a testifier, Jeremy Braun, who is on Zoom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Yep. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Jeremy Braun, and I'm a speech-language pathologist representing the Minnesota Speech-Language Hearing Association. And I want to thank you all for allowing me the opportunity to testify today. I also want to thank the committee for passing legislation last session to establish the license for speech-language pathology assistants. I am here to support efforts to revise the current licensure statute regarding speech-language pathology assistants to ensure that the SLPs that are licensed by the Minnesota Department of Health and the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board can supervise SLP assistants. This change is crucial to addressing the workforce shortages and improve access to speech services across Minnesota. Additionally, I urge the committee to consider reducing the cost of the licensure for SLP assistants, which, as Senator Bolden already stated, was $493 every 2 years, which is more than double the $200 to $210 that SLPs pay. This high cost creates unnecessary financial barrier for SLP assistants and who already earn significantly less than SLPs. Lowering this fee would help attract and retain more SLP assistants, supporting the essential work they do in schools and healthcare settings. By making these changes, we can strengthen the speech-language workforce and improve services for Minnesotans while reducing barriers for qualified professionals. Thank you again for your time and your consideration.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions about the bill? No questions. Okay. Do you know, so we're going to lay this bill over, and then I assume that the Department of Health will keep working on how we could set the fee and the amount that would need to be covered. And it does seem like that over $400 is not appropriate, but it'll be interesting to know, you know, how we can make it lower and still end up covering costs later. So do you have any other comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I mean, I think that's exactly right. We want to be sure that we are not creating unnecessary barriers for people coming into this field when it is so needed. And yes, we are in continued conversations with MDH. We have another meeting scheduled next week, and we'll continue that work.
Great. Okay. Well, Senate File 1534 is laid over for possible inclusion. And Senator Bolden, you have the next bill, Senate File 832.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Switching gears here a little bit. I am very pleased to be before you with Senate File 832, the Minnesota Certified Midwife Act. This is a bipartisan bill initially carried by Senator Coleman several sessions ago, and I was before you with this bill last session as well, and we passed this bill out of the Senate. I'm glad to be continuing these efforts and have Senator Coleman, as well as you, Senator Wicklund, Senator Abler, and Senator Mann as co-authors on this bill. I will note that this bill is also bipartisan in the other body. The U.S. and Minnesota have a maternal health crisis, causing high levels of maternal morbidity and mortality. We know that there are stark racial disparities, and large areas of greater Minnesota can be considered maternity care deserts. You will hear more from our testifiers on the racial disparities. I will give some ideas about our maternity care deserts. According to the March of Dimes report conducted in 2023, about 19.5% of our Minnesota counties are considered maternity deserts, based on availability of birthing facilities, maternal care providers, and percent of uninsured women. And that statistic is getting worse, not better. Pregnant women in greater Minnesota have to drive greater distances for care, and maternal mortality statistics from MDH in 2017 and 2018 indicate that 48% of pregnancy-related deaths occurred in greater Minnesota, even though greater Minnesota residents make up only one-fifth of the pregnant population. Maternity deserts in Minnesota are a serious barrier to accessing safe care. The situation will only become more dire as one-third of Minnesota's midwifery workforce is anticipated to retire within the next 5 to 10 years. Expanding entry to midwifery can help to increase access to more maternal health providers and maternal care. Certified midwife licensure is an evidence-based strategy we can implement here in Minnesota to expand our midwifery workforce, increase its diversity, and help address maternity care deserts. Certified midwives are not new to the United States. They are practicing in 12 other states already. And when I presented this bill last year, that number was 11. So already in the year, another state has adopted this. Certified midwives have been practicing in some states for upwards of 30 years. By establishing licensure for certified midwives, Minnesota will be introducing a new way to become a midwife, one that does not require becoming a registered nurse first. To graduate from a CM program, a candidate would have to complete the same science prerequisites and have the same graduate level midwifery education and pass the same certification boards as certified nurse midwives. I want to note, while this bill looks long, it simply mirrors the scope of practice for certified nurse midwives. Thus, most of the language is current law, save for some changes reflecting that certified midwives are not nurses. The midwifery scope of practice for certified midwives will be the same as for certified nurse midwives. It's also worth noting that the University of Minnesota is poised to start a certified midwife program at the University of Minnesota midwifery program, but does not want to start that program until CMs are granted licensure. The Board of Medical Practice and Board of Nursing continue to support certified midwives being licensed under the Board of Nursing to ensure consistent application of the regulatory requirements. There is no known opposition to this bill at this time, and supporters are present today and have submitted letters that are included in your packets. And with that, Madam Chair, would move to testimony.
Thank you. We have three testifiers, and I apologize, I don't know if I'm going to get your name right. Mary Signy Chovnacki. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and begin.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Mary Signy Hojnacki. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Wicklund and members of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. My name is Mary Signy Hojnacki, and I'm on the board of the Minnesota affiliate of the American College of Nurse Midwives, and I'm a certified nurse midwife at Hennepin Healthcare. The Minnesota State affiliate of the American College of Nurse Midwives represents all certified nurse midwives in our state. Our members are dedicated to providing high-quality nurse midwifery care to Minnesotans. We provide support, education, and advocacy focused on increasing optimal outcomes and access to care for Minnesotans seeking midwifery care during all stages of life. We are working with the Minnesota Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Coalition in bringing this bill forward. It has been our top legislative priority since 2019. We are proud that certified nurse midwives, OBGYNs, and certified professional midwives alike are partnering in this bill and agree we need more midwifery providers. The certified midwife is an essential piece to this puzzle in Minnesota to ensure access to the right care at the right time in the right place for everyone in our state. Currently, in order to become a certified nurse midwife, a student must first go to nursing school and become a registered nurse before pursuing graduate midwifery education. On average, certified nurse midwives practice nursing for less than 5 years before moving into midwifery education. With the certified midwife licensure, Minnesotans can pursue graduate midwifery education directly after the necessary undergraduate education, saving graduate midwifery education directly for those who wish to pursue nursing. At the same time, it would alleviate the strain on educational programs and allow for nursing spots to be reserved for people who want to become nurses, and something Minnesota desperately needs with the current nursing shortage. Certified nurse midwifery and certified midwifery are associated with consistent and often better outcomes of care compared to conventional care. Patients being cared for primarily by CNMs and CNMs consistently report higher satisfaction rate and feel more respected and autonomous in their care. Studies indicate excellent outcomes as well, as you will hear about some of those outcomes from Rebecca Polston, owner of Roots Birth Center. Support for this initiative is not only bipartisan in both chambers, but is also exists widely in the community, including Hennepin County, the University of Minnesota, various midwife and childbirth organizations, and the March of Dimes. On page 4 of the 2024 March of Dimes Minnesota report that is in members' packets, the research nonprofit outlines that Minnesota has adopted 3 of the 4 supportive midwifery policies that would improve and sustain maternal and infant health care in Minnesota. The certified midwife licensure is the only one that's left. The Certified Nurse Midwife Practice Act would expand patient access and increase and diversify the pool of qualified midwifery professionals. Minnesota has a unique opportunity to invest in that important initiative now and be on its way to addressing disparities in maternal health and supporting Minnesotans in every aspect of their health and well-being. Please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Dr. Todd Stanholm. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Chair Wicklund. I am Todd Stanhope. I'm an OBGYN physician, and I have the privilege to speak today on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American College of OBGYN. It's a pleasure to present on in partnership with our colleagues at the Minnesota affiliate of the American College of Nurse Midwives. I'd like to begin by thanking Senator Bolden, as well as the bipartisan authors of this bill for this important legislation. Senate File 832 is a key legislative priority for our organization because it will serve to expand access to high-quality maternal care by creating a new pathway for midwifery licensure. Expanding midwifery access is a proven, cost-effective strategy to improve maternal health outcomes. Studies show midwife-led care reduce C-section rates, preterm birth rates, and encourage breastfeeding success. Certified midwives, also known as CMs, meet the same competencies and certification standards as certified nurse midwives, with specialized training in lowest pregnancy, vaginal birth, and wellness care. They are governed by the same national board, have the same training requirements, and receive certification through the same examination. Senate File 832 does not debate the qualifications or scope of practice for midwives in Minnesota, but rather allows a new pathway to entry into the field. Minnesota urgently needs more maternal care providers, as now one in five counties lacks a provider, and these maternal health deserts align with health disparities. Nationally, 80% of pregnancy-related deaths are preventable, and yet the U.S. has the highest maternal mortality rate among developed nations. We must take action to ensure that Minnesotans receive the care they need. By expanding midwifery practice to include this credential, we take a small step forward toward a future where every mother, regardless of race, location, or background, has access to safe, high-quality care. So to summarize, Minnesota faces a maternal health provider shortage, especially in rural areas and communities of color. This bill does not debate post-training qualifications, but rather creates a new entry pathway to training and credentialing. And with time, this bill will expand access to midwifery care in Minnesota for low-risk pregnancies, which has proven to be cost-effective and, most importantly, improve outcomes. Thank you again for your consideration, and I would be glad to join my colleagues for further discussion.
Thank you. And the last testifier, Rebecca Polston. Oh, and I'm sorry, there is a Zoom testifier as well, but Ms. Polston, please state your name for the record and begin.
My name is Rebecca Polston. Good morning, Chair Wicklund and members of the Senate Health Committee. My name is Rebecca Polston. I am a certified professional midwife and owner of Roots Community Birth Center, a nationally recognized freestanding birth center in North Minneapolis. I'm also a member of the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of Certified Professional Midwives and the Minnesota chapter of the American Association of Birth Centers. Roots is one of very few Black-owned birth centers in the United States. I'm here to testify in support of Minnesota Certified Midwife Act, Senate File 832. Minnesota suffers from among the worst rates of health disparities in the country, including in maternal health. Black women in Minnesota are 2 to 3 times more likely to die at childbirth than white women. While just 6.4% of Minnesotans are Black, we represent 15% of maternal deaths in our state. Maternal mortality and morbidity are also rising overall in the United States and increased sharply during the first year of the pandemic. The majority of these maternal deaths are preventable. As Dr. Stanhope mentioned, at the Roots Community Birth Center, we serve predominantly patients of color, and we are proud that our midwifery care model is nationally recognized for cultural competence, high-quality birth outcomes, and strong patient satisfaction. At Roots, we work with the communities experiencing the highest disparities in our state. However, owing to the Midwifery model generally, and the birth center model specifically, Roots is proud of our virtually non-existent preterm birth rate. Our success in supporting families to full-term healthy pregnancies, regardless of background, and their sense of empowerment along the way. Birth centers are twice as effective as doula care, which we all love, but we know that more can be done. To do more, we need more midwives. We can enact common sense policies to improve maternal health outcomes and reduce disparities in our state, and Senate File 832 is one prime example. This bill would remove the barrier to certified midwifery licensure in Minnesota and expand access to high-quality, culturally competent midwifery care in our state. The CM legislation would not only expand access to midwifery care in our state, but also diversify it. Research from other states indicates that the certified midwife licensure leads to greater ethnic and racial diversity in the midwifery workforce. Personally, as an employer who's trying to hire midwives, we don't have enough midwives for me to hire. Also, I personally would be thrilled to pursue this certification to enhance our offerings, augment my scope from what it is as a certified professional midwife, and provide continued preceptorships for aspiring students. I'd like to thank Senator Bolden for bringing this important legislation forward and urge the members of the committee to support Senate File 832. Thank you.
Thank you. And then on Zoom, we have Kylie Sari. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, Chair Wicklund and Senate Health members. My name is Kylie Sari. I am a certified nurse woman midwife living in southern Minnesota in Fairmont, way down by the Iowa border. I'm testifying in support of the certified midwife bill. Midwifery is a second career for me, and I'm passionate about women's health and rural health. I didn't grow up in rural Minnesota, but after moving here and living here for nearly two decades, I knew I wanted to serve my community. I'm familiar with the specific needs of patients in this area, the resources available, and the culture that is so unique to these smaller communities. I began my journey to become a certified nurse midwife in 2016 by attending nursing school, as my previous bachelor's degree was not in nursing. After earning my BSN, I worked as an RN to meet the entry requirements for midwifery school. Once eligible, I enrolled in graduate midwifery school and completed my degree this year. It took me 9 years to complete the process and put me in significant educational debt. After all that, I'm unable to provide maternal and primary health care for my community. Although the local hospital was hiring for midwives when I entered midwifery school, by the time I finished, they were not only no longer hiring midwives, they had closed the L&D department altogether, citing a lack of providers. Not only does Fairmont no longer have critical maternal health care access that it needs, but I have to move out of this community to work as a midwife. Many competent providers willing to work in rural Minnesota have a similar situation. This means less and less access to care in greater Minnesota. That's for my family, my friends, and my neighbors. I want to work here. I want to serve rural Minnesota. If the certified midwife licensure was in place here, I could have graduated and begun practicing midwifery earlier, 7 years earlier, with all of the required skills, education, and accreditation needed, without having to shoulder the financial and time costs of obtaining a nursing degree. I would have been able to provide essential primary and women's health care to my community right here in Fairmont, and perhaps our OB unit would have been able to remain open for our residents. Policies like the Certified Midwife Bill that expand health care access are not only beneficial for the state, but are desperately needed for providers and patients alike. Every year that we do not pass this legislation is another year lost on the important investment into our communities, especially in greater Minnesota. Please support Senate File 832 to license certified midwives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions or comments about the bill? Senator Port and then Senator Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Bolden, for bringing this bill. It's something I've been watching for several years. And I think there's a couple of really key components. As our last testifier said, this could really expand access to care in greater Minnesota, particularly as hospitals are closing their OB departments, which is its own huge concern. but this can really be an access to care that is deeply rooted in community. Also, one of the worst disparities we have in our state is that of Black maternal health and Native maternal health. And so working with culturally competent midwives is an incredible asset to our state in a time when the numbers that are coming out of birth centers are incredible in regards to those things. So really appreciate this. This is the same bill that passed unanimously off the floor last year, correct? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Port. Senator Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just, I could echo everything that my colleague just said. This is, I think, a really good thing. I just have a couple of questions. So I'm a co-author, and any way you can get more people into, you know, more just normal birthing situations, the better. We intervene in far too many. So just to understand, so a person, this is like a mid-level thing that we're creating. So they go right from high school into this program, and then is that right, or do they go to college ahead of that? Can you just clarify that for me?
Yeah.
Please state your name again for the record and begin.
Mary Signe Hojnatsky. A certified midwifery education is a graduate education, so someone would have to first have an undergraduate degree, and then they would have to fulfill the correct prerequisites to enter the graduate program. And they may have received those in their undergraduate, but some may have not.
All right.
Senator Abler?
Well, I'm not even attempting to dissect the thing. I just was curious about that, and I'm curious to the last testifier, who operates the Fairmont Health System down there that closed down their birthing?
Mayo.
Ms. Sari?
Yes, it's Mayo Clinic. It's the health system, Mayo Clinic Health System.
All right.
Senator Abler.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know. What are we doing here? Today's headline news, Mayo sets record profits. Mm-hmm. And when they closed the Albert Lea Birthing Center, and different places are shutting down. I'm happy you're able to provide something, but what are we doing? What are we doing? God bless Mayo. And I don't mind them making money, but we had better serve our people in this state. And there's two committees in the legislature that are charged with this topic, and this one and the one across the street. And we make the best efforts we can to help people enjoy living in greater Minnesota and be fully served. We don't keep the grocery stores open, but this committee would be charged with the effort about keeping healthcare open. And, you know, as we dump large amounts of money into destination, whatever it was called down there, and which is fine, but I think they have a duty. And so that's all. And I'm just really disappointed. I was debating bringing it up or not. I just read it's in today's paper. What's a newspaper? Oh, they come out every morning and go to your mailbox, and there it is. For the people who don't know what that is anymore, but so it's just ironic that the woman who testified ahead of this was going to be a provider, but they were closing it because they couldn't find a provider. And so healthcare has changed so much, and I don't know. It's not political. It's just, we're not doing it well. You know, you can't blame a Republican or a Democrat or one system or another. They're just doing what we enable them to do. And we still have a system where we don't fund Medicaid well enough, and they don't take a lot of it down there, which is how they're so held. But places like North Memorial are closing beds, serving the very populations that we, on a bipartisan basis, say we want to help. And then budgets come out that don't have any help for that. And anyway, I'm just, thank you for this bill. And as a family that had 5 home births with traditional midwives and then a certified nurse midwife at St. Joe's the day I got sworn in back in 99, it's just nice to have that opportunity to have the freedom to have the birth the way that the family would want it to be and not be forced into a hyper-medical thing. If you need that, then by all means, but not be forced into C-sections and all that. So I'll stop, Madam Chair, but I thank you for the people who have been working to fight for this, and I'm so happy you got a coalition together and that nobody's complaining about it, but they're saying, let's help the women, let's help our healthcare system, let's help Fairmont, let's help Foston, let's help Albert Lea. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Abler. Senator Bolden, did you have any comments or no? Any other questions or comments? I don't see any others. I agree, Senator Bolden. I've worked on this bill for several years and been participating, and it just seems like a very common sense way to try and encourage more people to get into a profession that could really help more women. And when I look at the March of Dimes report card for Minnesota, and I think, you know, we have so much work to do to try and improve outcomes here in Minnesota. So thank you for continuing to work on it over interim and bringing the bill back this year, and we will continue to press on. This bill does need to go to the Judiciary Committee, and so...
Madam Chair, can I just make a couple
Senator
of comments
Bolden.
Before we...
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Thank
Senator
you.
Bolden.
Appreciate that, and appreciate the discussion, and appreciate, Senator Abler, your comments. Certainly, we have a healthcare system that is not working for people, and there is a lot of work we should do. You know, with that, I look forward to the work of this committee and with you to move forward for a system that actually does focus on the care for people rather than profits. And this is one step we can do in that direction to help to get, you know, bring this other pathway to bring more providers into a space where we know there are deep, deep needs. And as has been mentioned, to help close, you know, racial disparities, to, you know, help, you know, keep, you know, with our maternal deserts to help, you know, bring more providers into those areas. And so this seems like a win-win-win with no opposition and really that coalition that has been doing work over time to persist to keep working to move this forward. So I hope sincerely it is something we can get done this session. So thank you.
Thank you. So Senator Bolden's motion will be that Senate File 832 is recommended to pass and is referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Is that your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion does prevail, and Senate File 832 is passed and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. And next, we have Senate File 1786. Senator May Quaid. Good morning. And Senator May Quaid, I think you have an author's amendment?
I do, Madam Chair.
Senator, let's see, Senator Kupek moves that, moves the A1 amendment. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Any opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. Thank you for hearing Senate File 1786. This is about relative and kinship care licensing and support. With the A1 amendment, Senate File 1786 was developed from conversations with the Kinship Licensing Working Group, which was formed to review the new federal flexibility for states to establish specific licensing standards for relative kin foster caregiver. These federal flexibilities were born out of the recognition that our foster care system has really made a structural shift to rely on relative kin care for foster placements instead of the traditional method that you're thinking of where people sign up to care for children who need out-of-home placements. This is a powerful and positive shift, and our system needs to catch up to kind of actively support this method of care. And so here before you, you'll see things around licensing, family preservation, reunification, and really just recognizing that kinship care has all sorts of people caring for their kin, and that requires a little bit of a different structure. So the bill will improve access to foster care licensing for relative kin caregivers by increasing responsiveness to their training, their requirements, background studies, and support needs. In particular, many kin caregivers have children of their own already and don't need car seat training, like somebody who maybe has not had children before. This informs relative kin caregivers of resources and supports available to the children in their home, and it increases access to child care for relative kin. In Minnesota, over 60% of child foster care placements are with relative kin caregivers, and this is a good thing. More families are staying connected while receiving care and support and services that they need, and so I hope you can support this bill, and we have excellent testifiers who've done a lot of work in this area. I really appreciate their working group and their report to the foster care task force, which I've been sitting on as well. So with that, Madam Chair, I will let my testifiers say a little bit more.
Thank you. First, we have Anna Beltran on Zoom, and if you can please state your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
Certainly. Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to join you all today. My name is Anna Beltran. I am at Generations United. Generations United is a national nonprofit that's home to two initiatives that support kinship grand families. We use those terms interchangeably. The National Center on Grand Families and the Grand Families and Kinship Support Network, which is a national technical assistance center. We've been doing this work for over 30 years, as have I almost. Anyway, my work's included researching all 50 state licensing standards. I helped create the NARA Model Family Foster Home Licensing Standards, along with the ABA, the American Bar Association, and NARA. And now working with many other national nonprofits, including Marina Nitza, who's testified before about this bill, and who heads the Child Welfare Playbook, we have created the kin-specific foster home approval standards. For decades, while delivering technical assistance around the country, I would hear from states, why can't we have a separate process for kin and relatives? They don't fit in the non-kin world because unlike your traditional foster parent who gets their license first, gets the home all checked out, and then gets the child, in kin world, it's all backwards. The timing is backwards. So the standards and the process just doesn't make sense to be the same. So the feds listened. They issued a proposed regulation, an amendment, received overwhelmingly positive comments from around the country, from all types of stakeholders, and then issued the final regulation about 18 months ago. And since that time, I have, in all these years of working on these issues, never seen anything taken up quicker. 7 states, 5 tribes are now fully approved to implement this flexibility, and all states are on their way to implementing this flexibility. So we, along with those nonprofit organizations and over 45 child welfare agencies, including Minnesota's, kinship caregivers from around the country, including in Minnesota, helped inform kin-specific foster home licensing standards. We created these to help states implement that new federal flexibility. Because under federal law, it says that you must align and be reasonably in accord with national standards of national recommended standards. So that's what we're providing through this, this toolkit of standards. The standards themselves are common sense. They align fully with federal law. They are not meant to be lesser in any way. They just align to the strengths and challenges of kinship families. So they work to ensure that the children are placed in safe and loving relative homes. And they provide that necessary recommended language, to align with recommended standards. Minnesota has done a good job in the licensing field, and they've been very active in that working group, and I commend the progress you've made. There are some areas where you could align better with the longstanding federal Adam Walsh law, and a few areas are that your 5-year barrier crimes under Adam Walsh, you have them start that time period starting from the date of conviction rather than the date of the crime. And as we know, any of us who are lawyers know that that can be a long time after the actual crime because court cases take a while. So addressing that, you also have some non-Adam Walsh crimes in your policies, including you're only one of 2 states that consider terminating parental rights. So a foster parent applicant who's had their parental rights terminated is barred for 20 years from being a foster parent. And while crimes like that we might want to consider and look at, there are criteria in the standards that you can use to assess crimes like that, as opposed to making them forever barrier crimes or for 20 years barrier crimes. You also have background checks on children as young as 13. The feds say adults. But your practice of that neutral fingerprinting every 35 miles, and so that caregivers can go to somewhere like a UPS store and have their fingerprints taken, is a very excellent practice, and we like to elevate that at the national level. While it's good to have mobile live scan units that can go into the homes, this is a great alternative. And, you know, in sum, there are just decades of research showing that children thrive in the care of relatives. We know this. There's been a federal preference for placing children with relatives. There's been every state has a preference for placing children with relatives. And these standards are now common sense and make it easier for relatives to be supported in these homes. The children are often already placed, not in Minnesota, but not supported. So, you know, in this under kin licensing, a child may not get their own bedroom, but they may be able to sleep on grandma's pullout couch and smell smells that they recognize coming from the kitchen and be kissed goodnight by grandma. And that goes a long way for children who have already suffered the trauma of being removed from their parents. So thank you for the opportunity to join you today.
Thank you very much. Next, we have in-person testifiers, Christina Zizi and Kate Rickard. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Christina Zizi. Good morning, Chair Wickland and committee members. Again, my name is Christina Zizi. I'm the executive director of an organization called Ampersand Families, and I'm here in support of Senate File 1786. Ampersand Families was founded 17 years ago to help prevent older youth in foster care from aging out of foster care without permanency. We do this by finding a safe, loving, permanent family for them through adoption. Over time, our work has evolved to prioritize family preservation and relative kin connections whenever possible. We believe this is best for the youth we work with, and child welfare research demonstrates this as well. We work alongside families to address unique needs, but this is often difficult as we're working within a system that's designed for non-relative families. The system often creates barriers in our work to get relative kin families licensed. Some of these barriers include housing that meets licensing standards, transportation, mental health, chemical health care and support, financial resources, extensive training requirements, the lack of accessible paperwork and trainings for non-English speaking families, and affordable child care. But one of the greatest barriers that our system presents for families is they're juggling being a brand new caregiver, and they're also being challenged to check all of the licensing boxes that are required. It's important that families are licensed. Relatives cannot be considered a permanent placement option in court until they have an approved home study, which is part of the licensing process. We have had a number of relatives over the years who were in a race against the clock to get through all of these hoops of their home study so they could be considered in court because counties wanted to bypass them in favor of a non-relative family. Therefore, we support these changes to address and mitigate these barriers, including a standard for licensing and support specifically designed for relatives that will help us do our work with relative families more effective and efficiently. We can address barriers for families and ensure basic needs are met. Families can experience well-being and the kind of stability that benefits children and families. For example, right now we are currently working with a relative caregiver whose child was constantly on the run. She was engaging in unhealthy and unsafe behaviors, and since being placed with her relatives, this youth has not run away one time. She's doing better in school. She's no longer engaging in high-risk behaviors. I cannot state strongly enough the impact of a youth being placed with somebody that they know. And we all need to continue to find innovative ways to support this. We appreciate the flexibility in this bill, and I thank you for your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. And last, Ms. Rickard, please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Kate Rickard, and I am the Director of Quality Parenting Initiative in Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Wicklund, and all the members of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee on this opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate File 1786. QPI strengthens foster care by emphasizing loving parenting as our shared goal for all children. QPI does that by focusing on lived experience leadership, meaningful relationships, and research-informed services. We provide trainings and support for counties and community-based organizations and others within our child welfare services to implement the practices to improve parent-to-caregiver relationships, increase the focus of child development when we're doing decision-making, and bridging knowledge across stakeholders. QPI leverages the power of relationships and wisdom for those who've experienced the foster care system firsthand. And that's why I'm here today, to speak on the role of relative and kinship families who are experts in caring for their young family members involved in child welfare. Building the license process to meet the unique needs of relatives is necessary, and your support on this bill can help achieve it. In the fall of 2024, QPI utilized its resources of data collection to gather information from our county and community-based licensors. What we learned is that their feedback reinforced that relatives caring for children are overwhelmed with responsibilities, and this can delay the licensing requirements. Additional barriers that were faced noted by licensors included limited free time of the family, difficulty with the paperwork, maybe lack of access to technology, and mistrust of the system. Investing in the licensing and family support required to adequately meet the needs of relative caregivers is a must, and it is achievable. We have directly gathered feedback from relatives and kinship families. In our survey in 2024 on early placement, relatives reported greater satisfaction when these three things were occurring: when they received information on the foster care licensing next steps, when caseworkers spent time with them understanding what was their current relationship with the child's parents, and when caseworkers asked about their needs to provide care for the child. This legislation will improve responsiveness, communication, and ongoing care for families. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share about how improving the licensing processes and resources for relative and kinship families will lead to the greatest impact that we can have on our children, which is loving parenting.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have questions about or comments about the bill? Senator Coran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator McQuaid, with all the conversation or the description, and I think the case presented by all the testifiers is pretty clear. Kinship and family matters. So for me, I had custody of my first granddaughter up until she was 14 and a half, and two and a half years ago, we finally signed over to mom and dad. It is really important, and I agree with everything to try and streamline it for people who have kinship, right, the family, it matters. But the definition, the expansion of the definition on 1.15 on the first page, and also adding individual who's related, essentially is anybody who may know somebody who is related to the family. Means anybody, and so it goes beyond that kinship, that actual real family. We all have significant friends of families that are sometimes deemed more family than some of your own blood relatives. But we all have those. But in that case, what I'm worried about is how would any of that be validated or verified by the decision makers to understand what a kinship relationship or somebody that just has a material relationship with a child, that they would get the special or streamlined path to licensure than a family member? How would anybody be able to determine that?
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Curran for the question. And I think I'll rely a little bit on my my experts here to talk about the specific like procedural processes that they go through. But you know, part of I'll give you a really good example. My dad has a number of siblings, but most of them didn't live in Minnesota, but my mom's did. So my aunts and uncles on her side of the family weren't that close. And so if something had happened to my parents, the people who actually lived the closest to us that my brother and I were closest to are our godparents that we're not blood related to at all, but they lived like a mile down the road and, you know, they could be second parents to both of us. In that case, you know, they would, I mean, their house is the one I'm familiar with the smells with. They know how to cook our foods. They know where my softball practices were. Right? And so I think in that process, you'd find out both from either the parents or the children themselves or family members, like who they're close to and part of the interview of what is the relationship of that person with the family now. That is all part of that process. And so it's just recognizing that the, you know, kin or the family caregiving, it can be lots of different bloodlines or none, but the closeness actually is what makes it a more seamless transition in a really traumatic time. And I'll look to see if I missed anything.
Ms. Izzy or Ms. Rickard?
Sure. Ms. Rickard. The other thing that I would just add to that is whenever we're doing our licensing work, we're still going through and making sure anybody who is going to get custody of a kiddo is going to have the skills to be able to do so. So even right now when we're working with our relative kin families, there are some times where they don't make it through the process, and our recommendation is not that the child be placed there. And so I think we just have to keep making sure that we're going through all the steps of licensing and being certain in the work that we're doing for the safety of the youth that we work with.
Thanks. Senator.
If I may.
I'm sorry. Ms. Beltran.
Sorry, if I may add from a national perspective, we do recommend a broader definition of relative like the one that's in the legislation. And we do that because there are so many people that are important to these children and these families that help them keep the connection to community and culture. You know, for example, we have a Grand Voice that's a national caregiver advocate who, you know, is no longer the aunt because she divorced the husband. But she is very connected to who was her nephew, but for the divorce is now not her legally her nephew. So allowing for those kinds of situations, also tribal relationships, very important that, you know, they have much more of a community, as do Black and brown families in general. It's the village concept. So I just wanted to add that it is nationally recommended to have a broad definition.
Madam Chair.
Senator Curran.
Thank you for the response, and I think that the last statement was in the case of a divorce, right? That right, not biology, but there's a way to verify. There's some material exercise that you can go through and verify that. What I'm still questioning is because it's such an emotional thing, right? Very few children are removed, right, haphazardly, but then to go through that chain, we in many cases we're here because there isn't a grandma and grandpa on either side of the mom or dad, and sometimes and or even into the grandparents or the great grandparents, that either are disqualified, and or don't have the desire, right? So the natural, the kind of the closest in the family tree, but it still just is a huge hole that outside of a self-attestation, which is a friend, right? Somebody you love, it is equally that isn't. There's no way to verify that, you know, so from a material perspective to verify that, and that's why I'm asking is then to give them special dispensation that they can receive that expedited path through to licensure, because again, these emotional things, I mean, you know what it's like, just trying to get somebody to manage in any of those roles as trying to consider that you're going to take somebody on permanently a child because you didn't plan for it in being through it, but we still have a duty, and I don't understand. I get the whole family piece, but somebody outside of that, in every case, they seek recommendations of who else could be there. That's, you already do that, right? When you've exhausted that list. I was asked, the mother of one of my grandchildren is, because they were going to place her other three children, I have no relationship to anybody in that case. would I take those three children, right? And so we're already going through that. So, but to have special dispensation for somebody you have no blood relationship with, or some no verifiable, even in the case of a divorce, there's at least a material provable path besides a self-attestation. So that's my concern. All the other things, the kinship and the streamlining and you know, what we require sometimes can seem really burdensome. And so that's just a statement that gives me great pause with that. It can be anybody. The other piece is on the expedited, if you go on to section 16, and it really is, it looks like it's clarifying, so to simplify from a DHS perspective, for anybody who meets that criteria, what is that kind of streamline, the minimalistic, or the now, the kind of the clear path that if you meet the kinship, that they must not only provide the documentation, but they also must provide it so they can meet and accomplish the licensure in 30 days. What I don't know is today, how long does it normally take for a traditional path? I don't know that time frame.
Senator McQuaid or one of your testifiers?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Curran. So in the survey, they found that, you know, somewhere as quick as 90 days, somewhere as long as 4 to 6 months. I think there was one example of 9 months. I think the national recommendation is like a day. And if you look at the amendment as well, it changes it from within a month to as quickly as possible. You know, and part of the recognition here is, and I think a testifier mentioned that earlier, is that, you know, if you are a person who's applying to become a foster care placement, you do all of the steps to get approved first. And in this kinship case, the moment has already happened. And so now a child needs placement and is with you. And so then it's figuring out how can we get you licensed within, you know, as quickly as possible so that this is an approved thing, and then we place a child in the right place. And I think it's, and I think a testifier mentioned this too, the condensed portions that are necessary versus might not apply to relative kinship care are the things like bedrooms, are the things like, you know, the housing requirements, right? Some people live in apartments where they don't have the power to tell their landlord, hey, you need to update these windows, but staying with grandma or with auntie is really important. And so those are some of the things that we'll be looking at there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Curran.
Thank you, Senator McQuaid. And so I appreciate it. But again, and I get the whole, right, the stability of a child, first 5 years, this is completely, it's the most important development aspect of their life. No gypsy lifestyle, couch surfing and those things. But somewhere stable, even if it may not be. Your own pristine bedroom with the princess bed or whatever, it matters. If somebody goes through this expedited licensing under the kinship, because they technically then become a licensed foster provider, can they accept other children?
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you look throughout the statute, it'll say providing foster care for a relative child. So it makes it really specific to that placement for these purposes.
So it is limited then.
Senator
Madam Chair.
Senator Curran.
That's good. And then last question. So the disbarring list is very extensive. Mm. Are there low level child abuse crimes that would still be allowable, and somebody could still qualify under this bill? That's not. It seems like third degree child neglect and abuse and those things. Anybody with any lower levels, it would appear then, if they had some lower-level neglect or abuse, that they would qualify unless it rose to, say, a third degree.
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Curran, so if you start on 11.18, all of those listed there are permanent bars. And keeping in mind, too, that it's a bar for background study. It's not for, like, you're approved if you have this. It allows them to study it and see. And then if you continue to, I think if we're looking at 12.25, that's when you're starting to see if it's been less than 5 years, you can't be considered for a background study. Nothing related to like treatment of a child there. So we've pretty much gone through and listed all all the crimes, basically, if you look through the criminal code, in one of these places. I hope that answers your question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Curran.
Thanks, Senator Quaid. Yeah, it's very extensive, the list of just looking for those that are there cases that are low levels, complaints of abuse, right? That's what the background study, I assume, would be looking for. But if they had a low level of abuse that you'd have to determine, or a low charging level, I just can't see that clearly in there. So I'm good for now. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator May Quaid.
Senator Atkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a little follow-up to what was just asked, would there be any circumstances where a relative would be allowed to act in a kinship role, even if there was a history with some criminal background or some criminal history? I mean, there's a lot of things listed, but with that, is there still some openings there?
Senator May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Atkey. Yeah, there's the reason we've separated out the list is because there's crimes that are permanent bars, and there's crimes that, you know, oftentimes don't have anything to do with your ability to care for a child. A really common one that is occurring are grandfathers who might have, gotten into a bar fight when they were in their 20s. They're now in their 50s and 60s. They're wildly different people. You know, the bar fight had nothing to do with children, and yet they were permanently barred from being considered as a placement for their own grandchildren because of that crime. And so we want to make sure that we are right-sizing and following federal law. There was a mention, too, that it's just us in Kentucky that have some of these permanent bars or permanent barriers that don't exist in any other state. And just so making sure we are following federal guidelines and then making sure that the permanent bars are appropriate to the situation and not just, you know, sweeping in all crimes.
Yes. Senator Atkey.
Oh. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've heard this a couple times, just reiterating, this is following federal law, exactly right. No carve-outs or anything like that.
Senator May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Atkey, yes, it's following the federal flexibilities that were put in by the rule, so yes.
Senator Atkey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a question. This probably is more for Senate counsel, but going back to page one, when we talk about the definition of an individual who is related, by adding the language that's coming in here today, the individual is just a friend, etc. Does this change or manipulate the definition in other parts of statute? Are we going to follow this throughout statute, or is this going to be held just to this particular topic today?
Ms. Hoffman, let's see.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkey, the expansion of the definition for individual who is related, the added language, would just be for the purposes of family child foster care. So anywhere in statute that is related to family child foster care, this would be the definition that would be applied. Other instances, it would just be the current language that's in statute.
Okay. Senator Atkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's what I wanted to confirm, so thank you.
Any other member questions or comments?
Are there any over?
Seeing no other questions, Senator May Quaid, any final comments? The bill seems very comprehensive, and it does need to go to the Judiciary Committee, of course. I appreciate that we are trying to get this moving forward so that we do have more opportunities and more opportunities to help kids in a quicker manner. Do you have any final comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members, for the good discussion. Yeah, I really want to thank all of the folks who spent time in the work groups and the subcommittees for doing this work, because it is a tremendous amount of work to make sure that Minnesota statute is aligning with federal rules and really making sure and bringing their expertise to this topic, because this is not something I'm overly familiar with, but the folks who do this work every day are just really on the ground, deep into the weeds, and making sure we have a better system in Minnesota, perhaps the best in the country.
That would be great. Yes, there has been extensive work, and I really appreciate all of the testifiers and having the testimony from the national perspective, as well as what we're trying to do here in Minnesota. So thank you. So, members, Senator Port moves that Senate file 1786 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Any opposed? The motion does prevail. Senate File 1786 as amended is passed and referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Thank you.
Thank you. And members, we have reached the end of our agenda for today, and we are adjourned.